Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 207. Prison Stories and the Nature of Evil with Dana Houck. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Jungian therapy is a little bit different in that the soul is actually trying to find a way to speak. If the answer didn't resonate down deep inside of them, and if the affect wasn't there, I wouldn't accept the answer. Now, it frustrated them to no end because they would get mad because they give the answer that got them out of the hot seat in previous therapy. But if they didn't give the real answer and I couldn't hear it, I kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And that would make them really upset sometimes. But after a while, they began to appreciate it because they'd finally look at me and say, finally, somebody's being honest and somebody's holding me accountable. And I'm hearing the truth, and I'm not getting away with it before, and it really makes a difference. So they really appreciated it going down deep inside and not just skating through.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Dana Houck. You may recall that Dr. Dana Houck was my very fascinating guest on Shrink Wrap Radio number 173, Prison Dreams and Fairy Tales. He's published a new book, Life-Changing Lessons from Hardcore Cons. Dr. Houck is currently a psychotherapist working in Minnesota in private practice and is working part-time as a licensed school counselor working with troubled youth in rural Minnesota schools. He worked as a prison psychologist for over 10 years before recently retiring. While in the prison setting, he led numerous groups of men using myths, fairy tales, and dream work to assist their development and uncovering the reasons they brought themselves to prison. He also conducted individual therapy sessions using dream work with these incarcerated individuals, enabling them to work through issues surrounding their crimes, lifestyles, and perceptions, preparing them to re-enter society as caring and productive individuals. He's also recently published The Hooded Lady Speaks, A Spiritual and Psychological Conversation. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Dana Houck, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Well, I'm so pleased to have you back on the show. You left me and my listeners hungering for more. I heard from people who were looking forward to this book, which you mentioned at the time you were working on, and also listeners were left wanting to hear more about your Jungian use of dreams and fairy tales in your therapeutic work with prisoners and others. So welcome.
Oh, good.
Yeah, welcome back. So what led you to write this book?
Part of it was that I felt it was a pretty effective method and that others might be able to use it to help some inmates or even other people process some of the things that were going on internally. So I just thought, and I thought some of the stories were kind of interesting. You don't hear very many stories coming out of a prison, especially people who've changed.
Yeah, that's for certain. And, you know, I think I had announced on the heels of that I was going to be doing an interview. I was going to take a visit to San Quentin and record some podcasting there. And the administration, the administrative hurdles proved to be too daunting for me. So that hasn't come about.
Yeah, I've heard that from other people. It's just hard to get into to do anything different. They somehow, for some reason, they just don't want anything to change. So
yeah, I have a colleague, actually the dean of the university where I work, actually retired, but I'm back teaching one class, and she leads a class there. And I thought I could just kind of ride in on her coattails, and she suggested, well, write a letter to the warden, write a letter to this other person, write a letter to this other person. So I contacted the three people in writing, as she suggested, and never heard back from anybody. But that's water under the bridge. I'm sure you're familiar with that kind of rigmarole.
Yep.
Yep. So who's your intended audience for this book? I think you were kind of hinting at that, but.
Well, I think, some of them, you know, the inmates as well as the staff or the people who work in therapeutic situations with people in prison. I've gotten a lot of response from the inmates that have read the book. Some of them are in it, some are not, and they really like it, and they seem to get it. I've also done some work with people who weren't in prison and began to understand some of their processes just by reading some of the stories in the book.
Yeah, I can believe it. Having read most of the stories in the book, I can certainly believe that. And I'll be passing this book along to my dean who is doing prison work, and maybe she'll share it with people in San Quentin. Maybe your work will spread to San Quentin. That would be good.
Yeah.
Well, these are wonderful stories of transformation, yet you're not naive, and prisoners are notoriously adept at conning psychologists. Not all of them want to change. Maybe you can say something about that phenomenon, like how do you know when you're being conned and when you're not?
Yeah, that was an interesting thing that I learned. They were really good at it. They know the right things to say. They know since they've been through therapy so long, a lot of them have been in since they were 14, 15, they may be 30, 35 now. They know all the right words. They know how to posture. But one of the things that I began to notice, and I talk about it in the book, is the difference between the right answer and the real answer. And the right answer is just basically comes out of the book since they've heard it so many times and they've gotten by with giving that answer. That usually the therapist would back off. But if there wasn't any affect in it, if there wasn't something that resonated deep down inside of them, I wouldn't let them get by with that. And that made all the difference in the world. Since I used a Jungian approach, there wasn't really any right answer. A lot of the inmates have been in therapy for so long, sometimes 15, 20 years, with therapists who were looking for simply the right answer, the one that the book gave. But since Jungian therapy is a little bit different in that the soul is actually trying to find a way to speak, if the answer didn't resonate down deep inside of them, and if the affect wasn't there, I wouldn't accept the answer. Now, it frustrated them to no end because they would get mad because they give the answer that got them out of the hot seat in previous therapy. But if they didn't give the real answer and I couldn't hear it, I kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And that would make them really upset sometimes. But after a while, they began to appreciate it because they'd finally look at me and say, finally, somebody's being honest and somebody's holding me accountable. And I'm hearing the truth, and I'm not getting away with it before, and it really makes a difference. So they really appreciated it going down deep inside and not just skating through.
Yeah, you know, somewhere in reading the stories, I got the sense that you've got you've got some iron in your spine.
Actually, there were a lot of guys that used to get really upset with me. But the interesting thing that happened is that even though I would push them, and I would push really, really hard at times, I was never threatened at all. And nobody ever decided they were going to try to take me out. And the other people in the group, the other inmates in the group, basically, I felt they were kind of protecting me because they didn't want to lose this ability to finally get down deep into what was causing their misthoughts or their bad affects that they had. And so it was really kind of an interesting process. So usually there were about 12 guys in a group. And if somebody really got upset, I figured I had at least 11 guys that would probably try to protect me. At least I hoped they would.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I got a sense of that. At the end of the book, you include some letters that inmates had sent you over the years. And I really got that sense of loyalty and devotion that at least those letter writers had. And they acknowledged that it was tough and that you challenged them, but that they missed that.
Yeah. I still get some letters and phone calls from guys that have gotten out, and they really do miss it. They want to continue it even after they get out. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's fascinating. As these people come through in your stories, it's paradoxical because, you know, we have these images of these tough, dangerous guys in prison, and yet there's almost a kind of childlike hunger that comes through in the stories.
Yeah, I noticed that too when I was working with him, I think the soul is really hungry to be heard. And it's trying everything it can to be heard, which is, I think, one reason why some of these guys went into prison is that they were hoping against hope or that somebody would be able to listen to what was going on inside of them and help them straighten it out and try to figure out why they're doing what they're doing. When I looked at it from that point of view, it kind of changed my perspective and how to help them, that this is more of a cry for help than just selling drugs or doing other things.
Interesting. Well, let's step through some of the stories in your book, and perhaps maybe you can take us through some of the stories and draw out some of the lessons or psychological processes that they illustrate.
Sure. There's one that I try to think of the – I got to make sure I don't use the real name. That's the problem here. There's one guy that was in prison for stalking his wife. He was getting a divorce. He was also an administrator at a pretty big company, and he would try to find ways to follow his wife. But he also was like basically a kleptomaniac. He'd steal anything, even stuff he wouldn't want. I mean, he said he stole pipes and long, 10-foot pipe, and he just stored them in his garage. And when I was working with him, the only thing he'd want to talk about was the past, about how his childhood was and things he did in the past and all the different things he'd steal and talk about his wife and what she would do to him. And one day I just got kind of tired of it because we kept getting stuck in the past. And I looked at him and I said, from now on, you can't tell me anything more than 24 hours ago. I don't want to hear what happened last week. Maybe yesterday, but within 24 hours, that's all you can do. And he got really, really angry with me. His face was red, and we sat in silence for a long, long time. And finally, he began to talk about where he was at and the feelings that he was having. And he began to change and look toward the future. And which I thought was kind of interesting, that a lot of times people spend so much time in the past about how they got to where they are, but I think that the psyche is actually moving toward the future and is trying to get them to move into something new and something different. But people like to stay in the past because it's safe, it's convenient, and it kind of explains them maybe, but it's the future, I think, that's calling them, and I think that's what most people are afraid of, is to deal with the future and what life actually has in store for them and where it wants them to go.
Yes, I remember reading that story. And the kleptomania was interesting, too, because he was stealing the stuff that he really had no use for. Did you or he ever get a sense of what was behind that?
Well, I think when he was growing up, he never had enough. He always wanted more, and his parents weren't able to give him what he really wanted. But I think he was actually trying to get caught. And so he would steal just stuff and sometimes big stuff, just hoping that he would get caught so he could get some help. Because one of the letters in the back is actually from him about how that he'd been to different therapists and couldn't find the help, and he'd been on different kinds of medication until finally we opened up the psyche and began to look at what was he actually trying to steal. And my guess is he on one level, he's trying to steal the future, but he just didn't know how to move into the future and find out what else he could do. He eventually got out of prison. He's living in a different state right now, but he's doing really well. And he doesn't steal anything anymore, and he's moving on with his life.
That's wonderful. Now, he got into prison, you said, because he was stalking his wife. And is that right?
Yep.
And one of the things that you discuss, I think, in relation to a number of these stories has to do with the denied feminine.
Yeah, a lot of the guys, when we begin to talk about the feminine, I mean, they get really nervous and they think that they had some problem until they began to understand that it was the feminine actually that helped them to feel, that would sit down and open them up. It's the part of them, as I would often talk about, the part that could sit down with your daughter and have a tea party and enjoy her and be with her, and the part that would roll around the floor with your son and wrestle with him and take him out for ice cream. Those kinds of things they weren't used to thinking about, or the idea that maybe they could have to hold something and let it just kind of let him grow within them for a while so that some new things could develop. And when they began to understand that feminine concept, that's when a lot of change came, and they began to have a lot more empathy with people. They learned some patience. They learned how to wait for things, and so to some extent how to unhook the buttons that people would push, because they could process those feelings. They would go back to their room sometimes and write it out on paper. The interesting thing, though, is that they'd have to destroy it because they didn't want any guards to see it, because they might be accused of threatening or whatever if they shared some of the feelings about the head for people. But when they began to understand that feminine quality, that it wasn't tough, and that also that the world runs actually under feminine justice rules, they began to look at things just a little bit differently. And they kind of appreciated that perspective.
Feminine justice rules. You kind of caught me off guard there. I've never heard that said before. How is it that the world runs under feminine justice rules?
Well, things to happen in life, if you want to call it karma or something like that, when you do something, you usually don't get punished right away. Sometimes you have to wait until it comes around. Most of the masculine is you get in a fight and you get it over with, and it's power against power. Feminine doesn't work with power. It works a little bit differently. It's not quite as overt as the masculine power. And so it works underneath, trying to get people to where they're supposed to be, trying to get them to eventually deal with situations that they've gotten themselves into or issues that they haven't dealt with at all. So it moves a little bit slower, but it's a lot more potent, I think.
That's fascinating. It's definitely a different way of looking at it than I've thought about. So this guy got himself into prison. He was stalking his wife. So in some sense, he was seeking the feminine, that it was located outside of himself, and he had kind of located it in her and was desperately craving it. Is that pretty much how you see it?
Yep. And in all his relationships after his wife left him, he had a couple of relationships. He could never really tie into them because he would always try to make them either his mother or just somebody to take care of or somebody just to be with. A lot of these guys often just wanted a woman to be with them just so that they would tell them what to feel. So the inmates, these guys, a lot of these gentlemen wouldn't understand feelings, so that's why they often were with women, so that they would do the feeling for them. They project that stuff onto them, and then they'd ask the women, well, what is it? What's going on? What do we feel? Which I thought was rather fascinating.
Yeah. There's another story that ties in closely to the same theme, where the guy, as I recall, he was infatuated with a woman that he was observing from a distance, had never met her, but was having fantasies of talking to her and meeting her, and he sees her with another guy and ends up killing that guy, and that's what gets him in prison. Tell us about that story.
it's kind of gruesome at points. He fell in love with this woman from a distance and would somewhat stalk her and wanted to be with her, but she had a boyfriend. Again, this guy and this woman had never met, but we see her with her boyfriend, and he'd get really irritated because he wasn't in the picture and he wanted to be with her. And so he finally realized that the only way that he could to get her would take him out of the picture. So one night he waited while they said goodnight to the other couple, the woman and her boyfriend, and followed him home and got out and met him in the front yard and beat him up and took him around to the backyard and beat him up with a baseball bat. Left him there and went over across the street and thought about it a little bit more and thought that the guy might be able to move around get around. So he went over again in the backyard where the guy was laying down, and this time he poured gasoline on him.
Oh, no.
Intending to actually light him on fire, but he thought different of it and beat him up again, and then the man died about 3 days later in the hospital. all because he could not own his own feminine, and he didn't have the courage to talk to her, and even introduce himself. So he projected all this stuff onto her, and I call it, in a sense, it's kind of like an anima projection. He gave her all his feminine, and no one could interfere with that. No one could come in between. And since she had his soul, nobody else could be in the picture, which I found a lot happened in prison, especially some guys with crimes of passion. If they would project their anima or their soul onto a woman, and somebody would come along and suddenly want to be with her, or she decided that this guy was too immature to be with and started seeing someone else, that off that crime of passion would, because the soul was owned by the woman, and he had to pull it back somehow. But if they don't pull it back, or if they didn't pull it back, then these kinds of things would take place. Some gruesome things would happen.
Yeah, that sort was a particularly scary story, because the victim, boy, he wasn't doing anything. This came totally out of the blue.
Yeah, he wasn't aware of anything, aware of the individual at all.
Yeah, yeah. And projection, turns out, there's certain themes that I notice seem to run through these accounts, and the denial of the feminine was certainly one, and projection was another major theme. I think in one place you actually went so far as to say that you think maybe projection is a fundamental dynamic in lots of these guys who are in prison.
Yeah, because they don't want to own anything that might be distasteful for them. And so they get rid of, I mean, a lot of these guys are really good people, so they thought, because they wouldn't even own their own shadow. And so they project their shadow onto another individual and try to take them out. Gangs would do that in the prison as well, whether it was white or black or Hispanic or Native. They'd project their shadows onto the other group, and then there would be a sense of war that was going on between the groups. Projections, as I saw it in the prison, are really dangerous, and that's why we worked really hard to make sure that they owned them, so that they didn't have to go out and try to get rid of their shadow, or as they place it on somebody else. And then the streets, if they don't own their shadow, it really gets dangerous. Then stories like that continue.
Yes.
I mean, there were other stories where guys would, if their wife left them, would go out and kill both of them, because the soul would be, that would be, they could take their soul back a little bit and put it onto somebody else.
Wow. Speaking of the gangs, another important theme in there has to do with initiation. And you talked about how our culture really doesn't have good mechanisms or rituals for initiating young males into manhood.
Yeah, that I found that really fascinating, that a lot of these guys were actually looking for that initiation. They were looking for some older person, some more mature person to basically sit them down and say, all right, this is what it's going to take. But it's not an easy process. Again, I call it being pulled through a knot hole about the size of a quarter. That you're going to have to get rid of all kinds of crap, all kinds of perceptions to suddenly become a man. But it takes somebody more mature that can do that to sit them down and say, you know, you're full of it here at this point, and it's best that you leave it. In our culture, we don't have very many people that can do that anymore. And these guys in the prison found very, very few older men that would be willing to do that or even had that kind of knowledge or wisdom. And so they often would join gangs as a way to try to get that initiation. But problem is that same age people can't initiate same age people, because they all know the same thing. So what they're looking for is some older men that have been through the process, who are going to put up with their junk or their crap and hold them accountable. And they really resonated toward that, and they really wanted to do that, because what happened in the group is that some of the guys that had been in it and had been through some of the processes became mentors toward some of the younger guys, and they'd look up to them, and during the time we weren't in group or when they were having problems, they would go talk to these older guys and try to figure out what was going on, how they can process some of these things. So it really became an interesting kind of community for those that were in a group just of 12 people. And a lot of the other inmates could say they could tell who was in the group and who wasn't just by how the inmate walked across the yard. Mm. They held themselves in a little bit more distinction. Not that they were arrogant, but they just, like, they knew something, and others could spot it.
Wow. I have the impression that you were a really good role model for a fuller kind of masculinity, and that as people stayed in the group, they began to, some of them were able to kind of internalize that and become mentors themselves.
Yeah, well, I had a good teacher, so that helped. But they, I think there's they want that role model. I think even the younger ones today want that role model. I work in some schools, and I see the same thing. Trying to help some of these kids not go into prison, but they're looking for some role model to emulate. Nothing in sports or in the movies, but somebody real that can actually take them and care for them the right way. Care more about their soul than about their personality and what's going on with them. They're trying to help them to develop and to see things beyond the immediate.
Yes.
And we don't have that very often anymore.
That's right. I'd like to read you an email I received from one of my longtime listeners, Rick V, and have you respond to it. In part, Rick wrote, "I was wondering if you could do a show on the subject of evil. There's a great book by Dr. M. Scott Peck titled People of the Lie, in which he addresses the problem of evil and his early educational experience in which evil was redefined as psychiatric pathology. Subsequently, Peck, after a number of years in a clinical setting, came to believe that redefining evil in this way was nonsense. A point of view I strongly agree with, especially," this is the letter writer still, "a point of view I strongly agree with, especially since I have been touched by evil many times in my work as a bodyguard and to some degree in my personal life. Unfortunately, Dr. Peck is no longer with us to discuss the topic, but perhaps you could get a forensic psychologist who would be willing to talk both about the spiritual and clinical perspectives on how to deal with evil, or even better yet, someone who believes evil can be cured, for lack of a better word, and someone who believes that it is not a fixable problem with you as the moderator. I think it's a fascinating subject on every level." End quote. So,
okay.
So you as a Jungian, you as a guy who's worked in a prison, you as a guy who's had theological training and who's been a minister as well, what about this? You know, what is evil? Is it a theological problem or a psychological problem, or what's your take?
Evil actually is to me is a kind of a force that exists, and if people aren't aware of it, aren't conscious of it, it overtakes them and begins to manipulate them into doing things they're not even aware of. They get caught in a Jungian sense in a negative archetype, and they can't get themselves out unless somebody strong enough or who understands the process can pull them out of that negative part and hopefully turn them to see the more positive side of that archetype or that energy. But I found that the more unconscious people are, the easier evil has a chance to overtake them and to do things. But evil, to me, is an actual force that's very, very strong. As I began working at it with it about when I started in the prison, it was kind of somewhat predictable. It had it wasn't very creative, so you could spot it when it was coming, and it had a regular pattern. But as I went through the prison system more and more, I began to see it's almost as if evil evolved a little bit and wasn't quite as predictable, and it was becoming more vicious as I saw it. And it wasn't only in the inmates, but it was also in those that ran the prison as well, which I thought was kind of scary. Because they would simply become puppets of evil, because they weren't conscious enough to see what kind of things were going on. Because evil's, it's somehow, I don't know why it is, it's beyond me why, but it always wants to destroy, always wants to take people out, use them to create havoc with, if you'd like. But it's a real force. There were some inmates that when I would look into their eyes, I could see that they'd fallen in deep into dark or the evil, and I had to question myself whether I had the ability to pull them out. Sometimes I thought that they were too much, and I didn't have the energy or the time to bring them back. Because again, the windows I thought were the eyes into the soul, but there when you look at, and I looked at a lot of these guys in the their eyes, or that they wanted to get out of that kind of thought process, because it was destroying them. It destroyed their families. It was destroying them, and they didn't know what to do. And I don't know if there are enough people that can deal with evil. Because one of the things you never do with evil is take it on head on. You always have to come around the backside or the side of something. Because if you take it on head on, I found out it'll try to take you out. And so you have to sneak around it and try to, for lack of better terms, chip at it and kind of surprise it by helping people become a little bit more conscious.
Say more about that. In terms of an actual case, how you snuck around, snuck around.
Oh, well, there was a guy that he was a big man. He'd actually tried out for the, I think there was Minnesota Vikings. He was he presented himself as really, really tough. He's like, I don't know, probably 6'7", maybe 300 pounds, 350, and he's pretty much solid muscle.
Oh boy.
And he'd tried to intimidate people all the time with his size and with his voice. And he came into the group and was trying to do the same thing. And so I'd pick at him and try to talk to him about intimidation. And then what I began to do is began to work with him a little bit more about his feeling, and found a spot in there where I found he was somewhat vulnerable. And so I talked to him about being a child, and he was out playing and what that was like. And suddenly this big, tough guy began to break down. He actually started crying. After the group, it was interesting. He came up to me and said, "You snuck up on me. I didn't see that. I didn't see that coming. And it's not going to happen again." But actually, he softened after that point, and it didn't really matter that he began to show his emotion. And so, rather than just confronting him head on and saying you're a jerk and all these kinds of things, I came around the back side of it, and he began to actually help people rather than try to intimidate them. He would use his power of intimidation at that point to try to protect some of the weaker inmates.
Oh, that's great. Good story. You know, as psychologists, we tend to see that these things don't come out of nowhere. Generally, if we look into a person's background and childhood, you know, we can see that they were traumatized in one way or another or suffered certain kinds of deprivation, et cetera. And so then the public kind of looks at us, I think, as all too often being willing to sort of dismiss and forgive and not really hold people accountable. It doesn't sound like you're doing that, though.
No. They would be held accountable. One of the interesting things that in some of the stories within the book is that unless they began to say, yeah, for instance, there's a story in there about a young man whose father had set him up. They had some problems with some financial people, and they basically killed him. And then the father killed himself and left his son, who was 17 years old, to take the rap for it. And he would often blame his father, blame what happened. The bankers were these crooked people and terrible people. And I wasn't going to let him get away with that. And until he began to own that for himself and to realize, yeah, he may have been part of that with his father, but he still was part of the problem. He still committed the crime. And when he began, only when he would admit to that and with an affect and with the right and the real answer both at the same time, would I let him off the hook a little bit and then we'd process that and move on. The last thing that this was easy. And the inmates would tell you that's probably the hardest thing they'd ever done. In fact, a lot of the inmates, when the new ones would come in, they'd look at the new guy and say, "This is not going to be easy. This, you think coming to prison was hard. This is about 10 times harder." Because I would put them on some days the hot seat, and they would literally sweat as I began to probe and try to open them up and try to open up their feelings a little bit to see what was going on and where they're actually supposed to be, what caused them to commit the crime in the first place, and to try to make sure that they understood why they committed the crime from a psychological point of view as well as from the heart, so that when that came up again in the future, they'd know how to get out of that and why they don't want to do that. it was kind of, I mean, I was at times, I would cut deep into the sore. I mean, I wasn't putting a Band-Aid on it. I want to go down there and I would want to know why you did what you did. And I want a real answer about why you did what you did. None of this, well, it was my childhood or, you know, I got a bad gift at my birthday or something. No, that didn't cut it.
Yeah.
It had to be something real.
How could you tell when it was real?
Again, the affect was consistent with the voice, mm-hmm. and the body posture, and there was something in the room that just said, this is it.
Yeah.
You just suddenly descend into the room, and you knew that you were right there where you needed to be.
And you could see it probably with other members of the group. They would also come alive at that point.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And actually, again, they would sometimes just quiet down. And as soon as they could sense that, all right, we're getting down to that, and this is a crucial point for this person, they would be quiet and still and just wait for the moment to come. And then when the person would hit it, then in the first lull, because they knew better than to talk over me or try to do my work, in the first lull, then they would be supportive of that person. If not, these guys would tear these other people apart if they weren't going to be real,
yeah.
Especially the guys that had been in it for a while.
And I guess part of the power of working in a group format like that, too, is that the guys, when you're working intensively with one guy, the other guys are vicariously taking in some of that message and applying lessons to their own lives.
Oh, yeah. They would often say that after the group. They'd look at the guy and say, well, I was glad it was you. I had the same problem, but I'm glad it was you on the hot seat instead of me.
Yeah, right.
But I learned a lot from you. Thank you.
Yes. Yes. You know, one of the things that's surprising when I look at your background, I mean, I see that you, you know, you had theological training, you got a couple of different theological degrees, you had an affiliation with the Methodist Church and an affiliation with the Baptist Church, and somehow those two things don't conjure up, in my mind, Jungian. In fact, they seem almost in opposition.
Sometimes they are, but I went into it, if for lack of better terms, Methodist was more liberal than the Baptist, and so I got both sides of the picture to begin to try to sort things out and to learn some of the language of each. Because when people, especially the inmates in prison, it would try to go in a religious orientation, whether it was Buddhist or Christian or Jewish, I had enough background to say, I don't think so, or I think you're using it the wrong way. Especially when it came into quoting the Bible, they'd quote a little piece of it, and then when I'd finish it for them, they kind of panic because they knew that I knew what I was talking about. But it was just a different perspective, I think, because most people feel that religion is the way into the soul, and they're looking for it in that way. They may find it there, but I think there's something deeper than just an organized religion. And so to realize and understand that language, it really helped me understand what was going on with these guys in prison and spells in my practice, my private practice.
We might have covered this in our previous interview. I don't recall, but sort of how did you find your way into the Jungian world? You made reference to your teacher.
Yeah, I was going through a tough time and facing some internal demons and happened to run into and call an individual who was Jungian and began my process of working through and finding out what it was I was supposed to be doing. And part of it was to do actually understand both of those fields. That's why I've got all that education. I was kind of led to make sure I got both of those.
Yes, and not just a head education, but clearly it was a very much an internal education.
Yeah. Oh, it was. The teacher I had made sure that I went down deep and looked from the heart of the matter rather than just from the head. I had a lot of interesting discussions to make sure I didn't do that. So that's why one of the reasons I was able to help some of these inmates make sure they didn't give me a head answer. I know the difference. I'd been there before.
I was interested to see in the letters that the guys wrote at the end of the book, some of them made reference to reading Robert Johnson and James Hillman. And I was struck by that. I guess you turned them on to some of these figures, some of these readings. And, you know, I'm teaching a class right now where I have students reading a book by Robert Johnson. And so I was just struck that, and I've heard Robert Johnson speak, and of course he's quite old at this point, and he's a kind of a thin and meek man as he presents himself. And so it's interesting to me that these quotes hardened criminals find such comfort and wisdom in his writing.
Yeah, they liked Johnson. They read everything. Through the trickster in me, got a hold of all of his books, as well as Sanford's and Hillman's and a lot of other books. And they would read. I had a library, basically. I had about two bookshelves full of books that I'd gotten any way I could. And it was hard sometimes to keep some of those books on the shelves. They were hungry. They wanted to know. They wanted to read. They had a lot of time and they could process it. So they read Sanford and Hillman and Johnson and Bly and Mead and anybody they could get a hands on. And then watching some of the movies we watched also was an interesting process, and then applying what was in those books to the movie and then applying those to their life. Because it was the stories that Johnson would write, like in He, She, and We, and that when we would tell those stories or see those stories in a movie, it opened them up into a way that they could come into the scene without being hit head on, but they could see themselves as some of the characters in those stories and begin to relate that way. So it was almost like a third person. But once they got into it, then it became part of their life, and they began to see, as we discussed it with each of them, how they were that person and what that problem was and how they could overcome it and change the end of the story, change the end of the fairy tale for that, or the myth that they were living, so they didn't have to come to a gruesome end or a bad ending. They could change it into something positive.
Were there certain movies that you tended to rely on?
Yeah, actually, the Odyssey, the tape that you see on TV so much, that was their favorite.
I've never seen it on TV.
Oh, it's a shortened version of the Odyssey, but they loved it. I wore a couple of those things out in 10 years, videotapes. So I had to get the DVD. I was glad when DVD came out. But we'd watch that two or three times a year, and they would resonate because the story opens up a lot of different areas, like meeting the Cyclops, where they have to meet the myopic thinking. They have to get past that, the different seductions that happen in their life and how it can cost them time. Meanwhile, while they're off in prison or wherever for those years, life goes on for other people back home, and they have to realize that there's a cost to them being in prison and going on their journey because they chose to, because they were too arrogant to let go and begin to see life a different way. They also, one of the movies they liked too was the first Matrix movie, where it talks about the process of becoming, of opening their eyes and becoming unplugged from the culture and beginning to do the thing that they need to do.
Oh, that's interesting. I just took a bunch of clips from The Matrix and put it into a presentation that I do on the hero's journey.
Yeah, that's a lot of what it is. That's why even Star Wars, we watched the first Star Wars, yeah, which is the hero's journey, and beginning to see that they have to pull themselves out and be different instead of being. Sometimes they would simply want to be the crook, and there's a story in there about the predictable rebel. I mean, he wanted to be a rebel, but he was so predictable that he really wasn't a rebel. Everybody, he knew exactly where he was going to go, what he was going to say. And that's not the hero's journey of being the rebel, but they wanted to see that, and they wanted to change how they lived and find out what it is they were supposed to do, what task they had been given in life. And when we use the dreams and those stories, began to open them and saying, this is my purpose. This is what I have to offer to life. I just can't take all the time. It's now time to give back. And then, from those stories, we would get to the point where then we'd begin to try to restore what they had taken. But we worked with Pleasantville, which is that black and white movie, and then everybody turns into color.
Yes.
And they liked that one too, because they began to see when they incorporated their whole personality, then they were real people, and maybe it would be in color rather than simply black and white and see things just one way. And so a lot of those different movies, we watched Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, some of King Lear, And we just watched The Lion King and Beauty and the Beast and just all kinds of different things, telling fairy tales again, The Three Little Pigs and Snow White. And all those stories began to help them understand who and what they were and where they needed to go.
So this was the trickster in you sneaking up on them.
Yeah, actually it was.
Yeah.
Especially one of the interesting things in the Odyssey is when he returns and he's in his throne room and he's defeating all these other guys that are trying to steal his wife, and he stands up and says, you know, you have no right to steal the world that I created with my hands and the woman that I loved. And I would sneak up on him and say, I wonder if any of you guys have ever done that, actually gone into somebody else's world and tried to steal it from them, whether you did it with drugs or theft or whatever. And it usually would get really, really quiet as they began to think of what they did to other people. And so that's one way I'd sneak up on them.
Mm-hmm. Would you stop the film midway at that scene, or would you wait till the whole thing was over and then raise some of these points?
Well, we'd stop it right where we needed to stop it. Sometimes it'd take us 6 weeks to get through the Odyssey.
Yeah. That's great.
But they would love it. They liked that we could stop it right then and there and talk about it. And if they had any questions or if it seemed to fit somebody, we'd go there with that person and ask them what they thought about it. So, no, we stopped it right then and there. We didn't wait till the end of the movie to talk about it.
Wow, I love that. You know, that almost sounds like a program that ought to be packaged and distributed throughout the correctional system and maybe high schools. And it sounds like you've got a real kind of very practical technology, if you will, that you've developed there.
Yeah, actually, you know, I've thought about it. I mean, it'd be nice to be able to teach some other people how to do that and look from that perspective. Thinking about teaching, hopefully, I haven't talked to the school yet, but there's a college nearby that I'd like to go in and begin to tell people and teach people. Some of the students are going into corrections. This is how you need to talk to the inmates. This is what you need to look for. Going to therapy sessions, or people are going to go into forensic psychology and say, this is, you might want to look at it from this point of view. This is more real. This is what you're going to face. Because I don't think many people ever teach them. They just say, here, read the book, now go do it, and that's not going to work.
Right, right. I really encourage you to follow that impulse. I think you've really got a message for folks. Do you have another book percolating inside you?
Actually, I have two books percolating. One interesting thing is that when I left, an inmate sent to me, I'd worked with him for 5 years before I was forced to quit the group the first time, but he sent to me 5 years of his dreams, all typed out, and I thought it would be interesting. He was in for murder and began to follow the dream process as we began to work and watch the dreams begin to change and say, all right, we're done with that issue. Now here's the next one, and here's the next one, until he got to where he could be, in a sense, made whole again, and he owned what he'd done, and he all the affect was there about how bad he felt, realizing this guy's not going to ever breathe again or see his family, and he walks around every day knowing that and feeling that. But the process of watching those dreams begin to shift and change is really kind of fascinating.
Oh, that'll make for a very fascinating book. Be sure to send me a copy of that when it comes out, and we'll do another interview. What's the other one that's cooking inside?
Well, I think what I'd like to do is, it's the title of it might be The Soul in Prison, and talk about how and why people go to prison in the first place, what it is inside of them that may be looking for help that can't find it anywhere else. Some of these guys went to prison to save their life just because they knew they were going down the wrong path. And I think the soul created enough trouble for them to get into the prison, at least give them a respite from what they're doing, hoping that maybe somebody would be there to find some help or get some help. But also what happens to the soul to these guys that are in prison. Most of the time, the inmates are forgotten people and the people that nobody wants anything to do with. And so we try to make it as hard as we can on them, and the problem is that they simply become better criminals if we don't give them something of value to begin to change the process. But and then certain things happen while they're in prison, whether they become institutionalized or begin to figure some of this stuff out. But if there's nobody there to help when they're really in trouble, But even when they get out, I think the soul still has to process what happened. And I think there's a type of PTSD that these guys have from being in prison and committing the crime that they have to begin to work out and try to figure out. Otherwise, nothing changes and they actually become worse than when they went in. And so how does one deal with the soul in prison, and what happens to at different points in the prison system to the soul, and how do we restore the soul and give the person back their life?
Well, that's a good place for us to close. Let me just ask you, though, how can listeners get a copy of your book, Life-Changing Lessons from Hardcore Cons?
They can get it on my website, danahauk.com. It's also on Amazon.
Okay, great. And I'll put a link to your website on my website. So, Dr. Dana Hauk, it's great to reconnect with you. And thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
I continue to be fascinated by Dana Hauk and his approach to prison work. He strikes me as extremely creative in his understanding of Jungian principles and how to apply them to this particular population. It's very disappointing that the cognitive behavioral approach holds such sway in the prison system that it's forced him out of that job. What a loss for that institution and for those men. As far as I'm concerned, this is the dark side of the movement within psychology towards evidence-based treatment. There's no massive database of results for the sort of creative, intuitive approach Dr. Hauk embodies. I can understand the impulse to regulate therapy and to prove that consumers and taxpayers are getting something that works. At the same time, though, I'm not sure that all of the complexities of the therapeutic interaction are susceptible to measurement and quantification. I see Dr. Hauk as a modern shaman who invents a variety of techniques to speak to the soul. How can such a thing be captured, measured, quantified? Once again, you'll find Dr. Hauk's website at www.danahauk.com, and Hauk is spelled H-O-U-C-K. You can purchase his books there. I also see that he's available to work with people therapeutically by phone, so if you feel particularly touched by his wisdom, you might want to investigate that avenue.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long, just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe, you know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, babe, it's all in your mind. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Here's a synchronicity for you. The interview for today's show is about prison and the nature of evil. And earlier this week, the same day that I recorded this interview, I was contacted by Los Angeles AM radio station KFI. Last week, a woman gave a press conference on the steps of the San Francisco Chronicle to the effect that her father was the infamous Zodiac serial killer. Since I had profiled the Zodiac in the book I co-authored, This is the Zodiac Speaking into the Mind of a Serial Killer, KFI wanted to know my thoughts about the possible authenticity of this woman's claims. They interviewed me for 10 minutes, and you can actually listen to the interview if you're curious. I've put a link to it on the shrinkwrapradio.com website under the menu that says In the Media. You'll see a link to it as the very last item on that page. Let me know what you think. At this point, we have three or four people participating in our Shrinkwrap Radio Yahoo discussion group, and already some interesting conversation and recommendations have taken place. Please join the conversation. There's a banner link on our website in the right-hand gutter area, or you can simply send an email to shrinkwrapradio-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. Don't forget to tell your friends, colleagues, and family, and so on about Shrinkwrap Radio, and I really appreciate it when you mention it on your blog, Facebook, or Twitter. I had a great example of someone taking this plea to heart. I heard from listener Brandon Dennis, who is a librarian at the Mental Health Education and Resource Center in Christchurch, New Zealand, and he sent me a photo of a terrific poster promoting Shrinkwrap Radio that he's put up there in the library. Thanks so much for that, Brandon. I was so touched, I wanted everyone to be able to see your sign. So I've put that photo on the In the Media page as well. Remember, too, that you can follow my tweets at twitter.com/shrinkwrapradio. There are no new posts on our Frapper map. Now, some of you might not know what the Frapper map is, it occurs to me. It used to be run by Google, and now someone else has taken it over. It's a map on which you can post a digital photo of yourself, and it shows our listeners all over the world. Take a look at it and consider adding yourself to it. It's a lot of fun. You'll find a link on our site, or you can simply go to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio, and Frapper is spelled F-R-A-P-P-R. Shrinkwrap Radio is part of the ProMed Network and also sciencepodcasters.org. You'll find selected episodes on those sites as well. Have I mentioned lately that most of our shows have typed transcripts that you can download for free? Thanks to the volunteers who've made that happen. It provides incredible value, I think. We got a very nice donation this week. You know who you are. Please help to support this show by making a donation. You have 5 years' worth of content here, complete with over 100 transcripts. And I know many of you are listening on an MP3 player in your car, or you're jogging or walking, you're at the doctor's office, you're in a train, and you say, yes, I'm going to make a donation. Well, hang on to that thought. As soon as you get back to your computer, go to Shrinkwrap Radio, click on that big green donate button. And of course, I also appreciate your patronage of our sponsors using the discount links on our site for GoDaddy, PetMeds.com, Brookstone, and Budget Car Rentals. Okay, you kissed the Blarney Stone. I was too scared. We're high up. What was it like for you?
To be quite honest, now I thought, like, I've heard of the Blarney Stone down in my county, like, and I often heard them saying, like, kiss the Blarney Stone. I thought the Blarney Stone was actually on ground level.
Right.
Until I came to this old castle down in Blarney, I had to climb, I don't know, many steps up to this Blarney Stone, and then I had to lean back and put my head right way back, and it was the most nervousest thing I ever did in my life. I climbed Croke Patrick, I've done everything, but that was the most, very experience.
Yeah, they had to hold your legs, right?
I had to hold my legs.
So you didn't fall through.
Didn't fall through.
Yeah. Right. Thanks.
No.
Thank you. I love that guy's Irish accent. I hope I get back to Ireland someday before too long. Well, let's hear what our listener community has to say by dipping into the old mailbag. I've gotten way behind with the emails back in March here. First, we hear from David, who responded to my thanks for his donation. He writes, it's a pleasure to take you running to the gym and driving. Illuminating, fascinating, and fun. Thank you for your excellent work, and I will continue to support you in whatever measure I can. Best regards, David. Thank you so much for your support, both monetarily and by listening and by writing. I really appreciate it. Next, we hear from Martin in the Netherlands, who writes, Hi, Dr. Hightree. Now, if I recall correctly, I think we must have had some correspondence, and I probably confided that one of the family names is Hogaboom. And I think maybe he told me Hogaboom means high tree. So I think that's why he's writing me, "Hi, Dr. High Tree. How are you doing? I just wanted to let you know that I got a new MP3 player that's able to play shrink wrap radio again. So I'll be able to listen into your show again during my long jogging runs. I'm revving up for the Berlin Marathon in September. Today I'll be taking part in the City Pier City Run in The Hague, the official national Dutch half marathon championship." He goes on to say that Haile Gebrselassie will be attempting to break the standing world record, so maybe the City Pier City Run will show up in the news if he succeeds. I'll be happy to finish the half marathon within the time limit, though. I'm looking forward to listening to your shows again. Kind regards, Martin. Martin, I'm so glad that you're able to start listening again, and best of luck to you and all that running. Glad that I can accompany you on those long runs, and hopefully I dampen down whatever pain may be involved. Next, we hear from Nir Ben Zion, who has graciously provided this show's theme music. And Nir writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I just watched Dean Radin's video on YouTube after listening to your interview with him. I've been following him for a while and reading his books. It must indeed take a lot of courage to do what he's doing, publicly speaking about such subjects as psi. I wish more people would get into these things, and it seems that he's doing quite well on YouTube. I also managed to have a lucid dream recently after reading Robert Wagoner's book. I hope I can have more. It does seem quite difficult, but very rewarding. Thanks again. Keep in touch, Nir." And Nir, it's always great to hear from you. And I, too, find it very challenging to have these lucid dreams. I love them when they happen, and for me, they happen all too rarely. Although I have to say, I probably have not worked at it as hard as perhaps I could. Next, we hear from a ship psychologist in the U.S. Navy who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I'm a frequent listener to both Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel. In one of the shows, you mentioned the possibility of packaging podcasts with test questions as a CEU package. I think this is a great idea and would gladly pay a fair cost for packages. I'm a clinical psychologist in the Navy, currently stationed aboard the USS George Washington in Japan. Thanks for your great podcast and keep up the great work. The new technology you've added to the recording, editing of the programs is evident and makes the listening enjoyable. Sincerely," and that's Dr. Ryan, who's a lieutenant in the U.S. Navy, a ship psychologist. And I think that, Ryan, you would make an interesting interview, and I think I wrote you to that effect, but I'm not sure if the military would be open to your being interviewed. But I'm still interested in that prospect, so if that's a possibility and you're hearing this, please let me know. The CEU unit thing, I don't know. I think that's gone down the tubes. The guy that I was in touch with about this, who expressed some possible interest in helping to back it, who has the certification that we would need, he hasn't gotten back to me. Somehow, I don't think he's going to. So I'm not optimistic that that particular thing is going to come into reality, unfortunately. The next one reads, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I enjoy your podcast tremendously. I appreciate your perspective. I've learned a lot by listening to you and your podcasts. I also have a psychology podcast, www.psychologyinseattle.com. Let me know what you think. It's my humble opinion that there aren't many quality psychology podcasts on the internet. Do you agree? Your podcast is one of the few worth listening to. I thought it would be helpful for us to open up a dialogue. Maybe we could share tricks of the trade, cross-promote, have each other on the show, etc. I find that listeners will listen to all quality podcasts in a particular genre, so we're not in competition with each other. Sincerely, Kirk Honda." Now, in fact, Kirk and I have been in dialogue, and Kirk's podcast actually is a video cast. And we were planning to do one tomorrow, but tomorrow is, or not tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, which is Mother's Day. So I'm not going to be available to do it then, so we're postponing it for a week. But he's going to interview me on his video podcast, and I'll be sure to let you know about that and how you can see that when it's available. And then I plan to interview him here. So we have some exciting possibilities coming up along those lines. Next, we hear from longtime listener Jack, who writes, David, I just sent a contribution to the show, got to the last page where a PayPal account was required in order to continue. Is it really required? Hope you got the funds. If not, I'll try again. And happy 200th. Best regards, Jack. Well, Jack, no, I never did get that contribution, and I guess the PayPal membership is required. Even though you can use a credit card, I think you still have to have the PayPal account. So, hey, I encourage you to to follow through and try again if you hear this. I want to thank our sponsor, Budget Car Rentals, for their support of Shrink Wrap Radio. May I suggest that you consider Budget.com for any of your automobile rental needs. Using my special code of SHRINK will get you or your family or friends that you share this information with $30 off weekly rentals or 10% off for other time periods. With Budget, you can rent like a genius. There are over 900 locations in the U.S. alone. FastBreak is the Budget Express rental service featuring paperless transactions, making your rental experience simple and stress-free. Check out budget.com for details and use the discount code SHRINK, or you can follow the links from the shrinkwrapradio.com website. Okay, I think we'll call it a wrap for today. Remember to send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and that in addition to your emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. Don't forget you can join that discussion on the Yahoo group as well. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. You can leave voice messages using the MyChingo button on our site, and our phone number is 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Dana Hauk, for sharing his prison stories, and I'm sure we'll be having him back in the future to talk about his next book. And next week's guest will be Dr. William Emerson, talking about his work in pre- and perinatal psychology. Fascinating stuff. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.